Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome. This is Richard Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. I want to welcome you once again to Progressive News Network on behalf of myself and my co-producer, Ms. Mickey Royce, bringing you the voices of activists across the state. Too often, progressive voices, progressive ideas are not being heard in print media or in commercial broadcast media. So Progressive News Network and other like-minded progressive broadcasters bring you the voices of progressive activists from across the state. So I want to thank you for joining us. I also want to thank our fellow progressive broadcasters, Amy Tidd of The Amy Tidd Show, Gwendolyn Holden-Berry of Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton of Progress Toward Democracy, who's one of our guests tonight, and also Diane G. of The Wild, Wild Left Show, who's also a guest of ours tonight. Before we get into our guests, we'll be having a special report from Susan Smith of the Progressive Democratic Coalition, who attended the Sanford rally for Tremore Martin, and she'll be giving us a special report in just a minute. But first, a couple news items. Number one, it seems that scientists are finally seeing the evidence that all is not well in the Gulf. The dolphins in Barataria Bay off Louisiana, hit hardest by the BP oil spill of 2010, are, in fact, now determined to be seriously ill. National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration admitted on Friday. The agency said it was likely that the dolphins' ailments are related to, guess what, toxic substances in the petroleum, although the evidence of the link is not exactly conclusive. Scientists from the agency performed comprehensive physicals last summer on 32 dolphins from the bay as part of a continuing assessment of damage caused by the spill. They found problems like drastically low weight, low blood sugar, in some cases cancer of the liver and lungs. Yet the most common symptom found in half dolphins was an abnormally low level of stress hormones like cortisol. Such hormones regulate many functions, including the immune system. Lori Schwack, the lead scientist from the health assessment and control groups of dolphins along the Atlantic coast in other areas, did not manifest these symptoms. That from the New York Times this morning. Also, some of you may know, but I did want to reiterate this because this is very important, especially considering the activities coming up this spring and summer. The Obama did sign the anti-trespass law, H.R. 347. Only days after clearing Congress, U.S. President Barack Obama signed his name to H.R. 347, officially making it a federal offense to cause a disturbance at certain political events, essentially criminalizing protest in the United States. Of course, some of you may feel there's a discrepancy there between that and the First Amendment's adjuration that Congress shall make no law, but there you have it. It's up to you if you must want your constitutional rights. We must defend them. Also under H.R. 347, which has more commonly been labeled the trespass bill by Congress, knowingly entered a restricted area that's under jurisdiction of Secret Service protection can garner an arrest. This law is actually only a slight change to an earlier legislation that made it an offense to knowingly and willfully commit such an act. Under the trespass law's latest language change, however, someone could end up in a law enforcement custody for entering an area that they don't realize is a Secret Service protected and engages in disorderly or disruptive conduct or impedes or disrupts the orderly conduct of government business or official functions. That's what we call protest. Services as police to protect not just current and former American presidents, but also dispatched to monitor special events of national significance, a category with a very broad set of qualifiers. In the past, sporting events, state funerals, inaugural addresses, NATO, G8 summits, coming up in Chicago, have been designated by such as the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The division decides where and when Secret Service is needed. Also, a second item on the Obama administration, they've recently announced They would begin an interagency process to implement commitments made on human rights before the UN Human Rights Council over a year ago. Coinciding with the announcement, the American Civil Liberties Union put on a report that the administration has done so far. The report highlights areas of criminal justice, national security, immigration, where the U.S. must make improvements. It put forth concrete ways the Obama administration could make tangible progress in protecting and promoting human rights. It also suggests how the administration could address very serious violations of human rights. On national security, the report urges the administration to grant UN special rapporteurs unimpeded access to Guantanamo Bay. The ACLU, God bless them, notes the history of secrecy and abuse at Guantanamo, goddess bless them too, which makes transparency even more important. It argues that giving UN experts access is consistent with recommendations made in the U.S. Defense Department's own 2009 review of detention conditions at Guantanamo. It notes non-governmental organizations or international organizations, except for the Red Cross, have not been allowed yet to access those prisoners. The ACLU's commitment to pressing U.S. government to provide accountability and remedies for torture is also renewed. One more story I want to mention before we play the Susan Smith interview. Plans for the events this summer in Chicago are underway. After the city gave the protests initial freedom and a permit, they have withdrawn that. So now, let me bring on my first guest. Hi, is this Diane? Good afternoon. Is this Diane?
Uh-oh.
No, this is who?
This is Gwen.
Oh, hi, Gwen. Hi. Gwen, bear with me. I'm going to play the Susan Smith interview, okay, regarding the Tremor Martin event in Sanford.
Absolutely.
Okay, here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Susan Smith, president of the Progressive Democrats of Florida. Susan, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you interrupting your busy schedule. You're at a DFA training now?
Yes, DFA is having a training in Gainesville, and I'm here for the weekend.
Oh, that's great.
I think my fifth DFA training. I like it so much I can't stop coming, and I learn new things every time.
Of course, of course. Listen, Susan, the reason we asked you to join us today was to talk a little about the event you participated in Sanford. Why don't you go ahead and tell us about that?
Well, I did go to the event on Thursday evening in Sanford to rally for justice for Trayvon Martin, and it was very moving to see so many people come out, and because they're just finally fed up with everything that's gone on, the racism, the insane gun laws that we have in Florida, and just the fact that a 17-year-old boy could be shot down the way he was with, no consequences would have come from this had it not taken off through social media. On the national level. I started seeing tweets about it, I guess it was a little over a week ago. I hadn't heard the story, and I live, 100 miles away, so that didn't make sense that it had happened right in front of us, and none of us really were aware of it until we started seeing national activists and writers, people like Charles Blow at the New York Times, write about it. So I was glad that Al Sharpton picked it up and really started to get the ball rolling so that we can hopefully get justice for Trayvon.
Having lived in Florida as long as I have, and I think you grew up here, didn't you?
No, I grew up in Tennessee.
Well,
you can't tell by my accent where I grew up.
Well, what I was going to say is we both know that this is unfortunately far from a unique situation in Florida.
Uh-huh.
That, too many men and women of color.
Yeah, I know. To see what the NRA has been able to do, we were listening to Chris Hayes on the radio earlier on his show, and we didn't catch much of it, but they were talking about since 2001, the Democrats have pretty much given up on trying to pass any sensible gun legislation. And the NRA has just gone crazy, working with ALEC, of course. And, that's another... If any good can come from this tragedy, it's that we are waking up to the manipulation that's been done by groups like the NRA and like ALEC to scare people into allowing vigilante justice in our country. So hopefully we can get a handle on this legislation so we can stop it. I think there's even a federal bill that would allow reciprocation, I'm not sure what the right word is, so that gun laws, if you're allowed a concealed weapon permit in Florida, you can also take your gun to New York City where it's not allowed normally. And so hopefully this will stop that law from passing at the national level.
Well, you know, I've heard that the national government is going to be involved, at least in terms of some investigation. Maybe this is going to be the place where this crazy Wild West notion that people can be armed anywhere in national parks, in schools, maybe this is where people suddenly find that that is not the way to have a sensible society. But I think far more important is the question of how do men and women of color face justice? How does justice face the communities of color? Because unfortunately for far too long that subject's been taboo, and too many bad actors have been involved, have been allowed to play out a hand that is so much antithetical to justice.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's happening with the voter suppression laws. It's happening with the restoration of rights. There really is a war not only on women. There's a war on minorities in this country, especially African-American males. And we need to stop all these wars on our own people.
If you could characterize some of the more poignant moments of the Sanford event, what would you say?
Well, I'll tell you one moment that I thought stands out was when Corinne Brown had spoken and the mayor spoke, and which is really, I mean, this mayor has really gotten out in, not in front of the issue, but he's trying to do the right thing. And he spoke, and there was booing from the crowd. And then she came back up. Before she would move on with the program, she explained how he had been in Washington. He had flown up there to work with the Justice Department, and how she had been in meetings with him and what he was trying to do. And she kind of called the crowd out. But other than that, the crowd was very solemn. You know, there was no rowdiness, no ugly behavior on the parts of people who were frustrated. It was just very moving. There was another case that I thought was, there were tears when this happened. As we were leaving, there was a woman coming in with a sign, and her back was to me, but there were three policemen standing on the street, and she was in front of them screaming and crying hysterically, and she said, "That could have been my son." She said, "I've got three boys," and she said, "I closed my business to drive 4 hours to get here today." And she said, "I don't know how you could do this." And, you know, it wasn't fair to take it out on those three policemen, who even knows if they were from Sanford. But just the raw emotion that was coming from her. You know, the other thing is the religious aspect of it, because there were many ministers who spoke that night before Reverend Sharpton did, and that also, you know, the prayers and just the respect and I think desperation to people, and they were there with their children. There were so many children there, babies in strollers and babies, you know, being carried in backpacks, those front packs, whatever you call them, I can't remember. So it was very, very touching.
Well, you know, I mean, I wish I could say that I hope that Florida's legislature is shamed into some better behavior, but given the current makeup, it's hard to believe. I did notice with some pleasure that one of the people instrumental in getting that law passed here in Florida has spoken that in this case he did not, to the best of his knowledge, think that it applied.
Right, but the fact that it's in the heads of law enforcement that this could even be a possibility.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think this could be a turning point. I know that the black legislators are trying to get the governor to appoint them to the task force or whatever. I think it's a task force he's going to have on security and safety and, you know, the rights of people, the homeowners associations and neighborhood watch people to protect their neighborhoods. I think he's calling together a task force, and I know some of the Democrats are asking to be on it. There is a chance here to maybe bring back some sanity, because I think they're all embarrassed about it. I wish they would all apologize for this law. I mean, there were many Democrats who supported it, too, and I think it's time for them to do some soul-searching. All of them have come out and say they made a mistake.
Well, thank you so much for interrupting your morning. I know you're getting ready for that session. Thanks so much for being here with us today, and thank you so much for going to that event. Hopefully, we're turning the tide. There will be no more youngsters of color who are...
I hope so. I hope so. Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You have a real good day, Susan. Thanks again. Now, that was Susan Smith, the president of the Progressive Coalition Democratic Party of Florida. Let me welcome my good friend, my dear fellow progressive broadcaster, Gwen. Gwen, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome, Rick. I mean, she did a wonderful job, didn't she? She just described the whole event with an anchor of sincerity that really this whole subject really begs to have.
Well, I wanted to bring that topic up as part of our peace discussions tonight. I think it's wholly appropriate, but I do want to pretty much focus on our international situations. Gwen, let me ask you to hold for 1 second. Let me bring Sandy Davies on.
Certainly. Yeah. Hi, Rick.
Oh, hi. Welcome, sir. Welcome. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Yeah, that's good.
Feeling good about various things that we're all working on, you know, trying to make some progress here because, you know, as you know, I work with PDA, and our political director, Steve Cobble, said the other day, if we can't get our so-called representatives to pay attention to us now in an election year when they're looking for our votes, then we're never going to be able to. So, you know, PDA is working on some initiatives relating to that, how we actually seize the moment here and get some progress on peace issues.
You know, it's the amount of tragedy is really hard to wrap your arms around. When you think on the one hand about the recent issues, the ones that are in the foreground of America's consciousness. I'm referring to, for example, not just this most recent disaster in Afghanistan where the lives of 16 or 17 innocent people were taken by a soldier who was clearly overwhelmed by all that he has gone through, but I think it's important to also keep in our foreground Mr. Bradley Manning, who is also a soldier who's been greatly put upon in the efforts that he's made. I think both these soldiers illustrate different poles of the incredible inhuman demands made. At the same time, not to be flip, but I can't help but reflect that Vice President Cheney just had a heart transplant. Now, I'd like to think that this is going to make him a little more compassionate person. We have a situation where with multiple wars, both declared and undeclared, we have more and more soldiers committed across the globe, and yet we seem to have no money for health care, no money for schools, but seemingly an unlimited fund for war. Do either one of you want to take up that topic just for a second?
Certainly.
Well,
you know where it's heading, Rick, too?
Go ahead.
I mean, when enough people begin to protest actively because of the sanity that you just described about not enough money for the health care of a nation and all of the other issues piled onto it, people are sort of deadened by the war. That nobody really wants war, and we're in an election year. What we really have to face to right now and pay attention to and protest adamantly is the drone wars.
You know, we have more soldiers dying by their own hand than by those who've been painted as the enemies of this country. And it seems to roll off the country, roll off the American attention span. There seems to have no impact. You know, how can they think they can keep abusing these young people, putting them in harm's way, putting them in inhuman situations, and then when they see these deaths, soldiers dying by their own hand in greater numbers, this has to tell you something's dramatically wrong.
Yeah, as David Swanson said at the United National Anti-War Coalition conference a couple of days ago, we are now being told that the wars must continue so that our troops, who are dying more from suicide than anything else, will not be killing themselves in vain.
Gwen, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I don't understand how you can even equivocate that way. How could anyone sanely stand in front of people and explain that as a reason for war? I mean, there is a tolerance level that America, I think, is fast coming to the breaking point on. Service by just what you were talking with Susan about with the stand and defend law. The social conversation and political conversation in the country is bringing us to a point, a catalyzing point, where people are just going to say, in the words of, you know, the old movie, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And I do say, again, you know, that I think what's following on the heels of this, when people begin to make a large show of, you know, a voting block showing of being disagreeable to the continuation of war, it's going to become drone war.
Well, you know, Sandy, you raise a good point about drone war. Gwen, you're talking about drone war. You know, I shudder to think, since they don't care about human lives, American soldiers' lives, you know, how much more casual, how much more easy it would be to have these drone wars when we have exoskeletons as soldiers and these drones committing mass murder. You know, they say now they don't count the enemy casualties. There has to be some rep for this casual loss of life, whether civilian or military soldiers. You know, a progressive many, many years ago, turn of the last century, used to say a rifle is a industrial tool with a victim at both ends. And that's true, and it's true of a missile as well. I worry so much about my country. I can't seem to pay attention to the fact that there are so many soldiers dying, that our veterans are unfunded. I'm sure you heard during the discussion of the Simpson-Bowles economic discussion, former Senator Simpson was heard to say that veterans are a real drag on the economy. It's a real shame we have to waste money keeping them healthy. You know, that kind of inhumanity is just boggles my mind. You know, they're not paying attention. Go ahead.
It can't be tolerated. We really have to keep speaking out about this and bringing those instances of inhumanity by our leadership to the public ear.
Yeah, I think we need to think too about just how this has evolved under the Obama administration, because, you know,
yeah.
I mean, essentially after after the Bush administration came in, really believing in a, you know, complete mythology about American military power, that we could just roll into one country after another and, you know, destroy their governments and remake their societies, establish military bases, and you know, in Iraq, and of course take over their oil. In Iraq, none of that worked. You know, basically, despite trying to put a brave face on it, you know, the U.S. was sent packing with its tail between its legs after launching a war that probably killed more than 1 million people. So now, you know, the people in the Pentagon and the Obama administration have sort of rethought this whole problem, And essentially what they have done is to shift from these hostile military occupations with hundreds of thousands of troops. You know, we are now gradually trying to somehow get out of Afghanistan without, you know, having a complete loss as we did in Iraq. So the new strategy basically now is targeted killings, occupying the oceans, shifting. There's been huge investment in new ships and in essentially turning a whole class of destroyers into anti-ballistic missile Aegis platforms to surround China, Russia, Iran, and any other potential enemies, so that if we should decide to launch a massive attack against them, you know, they will not be able to fire missiles back at us. And then also the third prong in this, besides the targeted killings, which of course, you know, includes drones, night raids by special operations forces, and, you know, targeted airstrikes. So we have targeted killings, we have occupying the oceans, and the third string in this is proxy wars led by U.S. and NATO special forces, of which Libya is now the, you know, the model, which, of course, they're now struggling to figure out how they can apply to Syria and other places. Every one of these aspects of Obama's policy and Obama's change in policy represents just a huge new danger to us and to the world. In addition, of course, to justifying continued military budgets that are 25% higher than anything we had during the Cold War. I guess one thing we could do here is just to look at the dangers posed by each of these strategies, since these are the new strategies of the U.S. government. And Gwen brought up drones, and this is part of an evolving policy since Vietnam, where the U.S. lost 60,000 of our people for probably 2.5-3 million Vietnamese killed. You know, there's been an evolution where in Iraq, despite 1 million Iraqis dying, we only lost 4,500 of our troops. So we, between Vietnam and Iraq, you could say that we reduced our casualties to less than 10%, while only reducing the casualties among civilians and resistance fighters by half. So you can see in the cost of blood analysis, in terms of American casualties, you know, this has made war once again something where the casualties are more tolerable politically to the American public. Now then we come along with drones, and now here we have a new technology that actually offers the promise of inflicting heavy casualties on the ground with no U.S. casualties at all. Now, in the immediate term, of course, as we understand, you know, the consequences of that are just generating more and more people who will find other ways to strike back at us.
Exactly. Gwen, you had a comment to make.
Well, I would say that now I make friends through my social networks that are like family. I get to know people all over the world, and I have a really good friend in Pakistan, who in her neighborhood has seen the destruction, the attack of a U.S. drone I mean, she knows that it's not the American people, it's the actually the leadership of my country as it is the leadership of her country. My point being, I would say, Sandy, I think that people, humanity, through this global consciousness of the internet, is basically enabling a new element in making a difference, and that's the social action and the social interaction between people, having enough and saying so, and making that a powerful tool. I do think there is something to say about that.
Yes. Yeah, so then the next question is how do we turn that into something that can actually affect the policy of our government, which is responsible for so much of this?
Well, you see, luckily we have a democracy where we can actually elect our government, in theory. You know, you made a
in
comment
theory.
That, Sandy, I wanted to pick up on. I heard an interview with some troops who were on that same mission with, I guess it's Master Sergeant Bales. And he made a comment that as they walked away among themselves, the soldiers were talking, and they said, well, we're making new terrorists every day.
Yeah.
And that's part of the cost of this war that seemingly goes completely unreckoned, except by those of us who were concerned about this casual slaughter of both American troops as well as the civilian populations of these countries who we are ostensibly helping. And go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, this is the problem from day one with the whole concept of a war on terror. If you check the U.S. State Department website and look at its reports on terrorism, the result of the U.S. war on terror has been a 30-fold increase in terrorism worldwide. We've gone from, I think it was 347 incidents of terrorism in the world in 2001, including the attacks or the crimes, shouldn't call them attacks because it wasn't a country that attacked us, but the crimes of September the 11th. So we've gone from 347 to then, of course, we declared war on terrorism, so we were going to stop all that. And the last couple of years, there have been, I think it's about 9 or 10,000 incidents each year of terrorism counted by the U.S. State Department. So this is, you know, when you declare war on something, you damn well better be able to win. And this is not a war that there was ever any prospect that we could actually win. What we have done is in fact, to indulge in a huge orgy of violence. And, you know, in terms of terrorism, who are the terrorists? I mean, we distinguish between, you know, state terrorism and non-state terrorism. The people in I saw people on TV in Afghanistan this past week calling us terrorists, calling the United States terrorists for what they're doing over there, for what, you know, Sergeant Bales did and all the other the night raids and the drone strikes and the airstrikes that are killing civilians. I think it's also in terms of when we talk about warfare, you know, I mean, we should put that in quotes because the laws of war actually make clear distinctions between warfare, which takes place between armed combatants, between armies of different countries, and war crimes in which armed forces kill civilians. And a great deal of what we are involved in is not warfare, but war crimes. And in fact, talking about the targeted killings and the special forces night raids, the whole targeted killing program that Obama has massively expanded. He expanded night raids in Afghanistan from 20 a month to 1,000 a month between 2009 in 2011. So I'm talking about this whole strategy of targeted killing. John Bellinger, who was in fact the State Department legal advisor for the Bush administration, has told the Washington Post a couple of years ago that there is no legal basis for most of these killings and most of these attacks, because all of this is being done, according to Obama's lawyers, based on the 2001 authorization for the use of military force, which was passed after September the 11th. Now, but what that bill actually said was that the president could authorize the use of force against anyone who he believed to have been responsible in any way or linked to the crimes of September the 11th in 2001. But as John Bellinger pointed out to the Washington Post, most of the people who the Obama administration is targeting had absolutely nothing to do with the crimes of September the 11th. And so there is no legal authority for these attacks. These are war crimes, not acts of war.
I had the...
How do you put that?
Go ahead, Gwen. Go ahead.
Well, Sandy, how would you suggest that we thrust that into the consciousness of America? How do we bring that to America's awareness clearly, crisply?
Well, I wrote an article which was published in this month's Z Magazine. That's the March edition of Z Magazine, which you can pick up at Barnes & Noble. You used to be able to pick up at Borders till they went out of business. One corporation bit the dust there. But, you know, you can also read it. Actually, you can read my article online without a subscription. Just go to zmag.org. The article is titled America's Death Squads. And it really just talks about this entire program of targeted killing, the illegality of it, and so on.
We are cultivating wonderful new tools through activism and protest, and I would bring to the front social actions. You know, I'm talking about Occupy. I mean, we have wonderful new tools that we're working with. Because you're putting so much information, needed information out there in front. It just seems to me that what we need to do is to filter this information out through the kind of social actions and protests. I mean, you know, the sound of our feet on the streets and the sound of our voices in unity.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think we need a sort of three-pronged approach. I mean, one is educational, and you know, I'm a writer, so I'm pretty involved in that. The second is taking it to the street, and the Occupy movement has done a better job of that than the rest of us had done for quite a while. And then the third thing is concerted political action. And, you know, again, we're working with PDA. We currently are working on a campaign supporting Barbara Lee's bill, H.R. 780, which is her bill for a safe and orderly withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan.
Yeah.
It would prohibit the spending of one more penny for anything but a safe and orderly withdrawal from Afghanistan. And week after week, more and more members of Congress are signing on to this bill. She now has 70 sponsors on this bill. So what PDA is doing, we are, you know, we've been going through lists, so looking at, you know, really the entire Congress, you know, how have people voted on Afghanistan in the past, who are members of the Progressive Caucus, and really just, and we're working with United for Peace and Justice on this, Rusty Eisenberg and those people.
That's wonderful.
And we, Barbara Lee wants, by the time she goes to the Democratic convention in the summer, she wants to have 100 co-sponsors on that bill. So we're trying to help her get them. And we had a really good meeting with a staffer at Frederica Wilson's office on Wednesday, after which PDA's deputy field director went on Thursday and had a meeting with Wilson herself in Washington. She's now a holdout on this because of the 76 members of the Progressive Caucus in Congress. The Progressive Caucus is the best-kept secret in American politics. The corporate media pretends they don't exist, but there are 76 of them. And they, you know, they're really the good guys in Congress, the ones who actually represent their constituents and stand for peace and social and economic justice. Wilson is, you know, I'm ashamed to say, because I live in her district, and we've been working her on this for, you know, over a year now. You know, she still has not signed on, but she's now sticking out like a sore thumb because she's one, by my count, of only 13 or 14 of the so-called progressives in Congress who has not signed on to this. But there are, you know, there are wherever people live, you know, we've really got a nationwide campaign going to get more members signed on to this bill. And what I would advise people to do, you can go to Peace Action's website, and you can look at their latest voting record analysis, which is actually from 2010. You can look at how your rep voted. There were four bills that they counted in relation to Afghanistan in 2010. You can see how your rep voted on each of those. One of them was actually an amendment that said exactly what H.R. 780 says. So you can see how your rep voted on that. You can see how your rep voted on these other bills in relation to Afghanistan. And then please just call your representative and ask them to sign on as a co-sponsor of H.R. 780. This is the momentum is really building on this. And this, you know, as I said, it's an election year. If we can't get them to listen to us now, we never will. So this is the time.
Sandy, let me ask you, if when you get a chance, please look up that exact address so we can have you announce that, because we want to make it as easy as possible for people to connect to that information. Let me just read a couple some numbers that I searched for online today. From the WikiLeaks totals, from the WikiLeaks war logs, they're saying documented civilian deaths in Iraq are from 105,000 to 115,000, and that's probably a low number. They're saying for the cost of war in Iraq, Americans' official total wounded is 33,000. The estimate, though, is well over 100,000. They're saying for coalition military fatalities from 2003 to 2012, 4,804. But we know how numbers are adjusted so that if you receive a terrible wound and are shipped out of area and you don't die till you get to a secondary or a third location, you're not declared killed in combat. So. And also, Afghanistan coalition fatalities, these are the U.S. government's records. They're saying that from 2001 to 12, 2,935. We know that these numbers are probably kept artificially low. I do want to run another story by you, and this was a personal experience.
Hey, Rick, can I just respond on the casualties?
Absolutely, absolutely. Go ahead.
Simply on the Iraqi casualties, because
right.
That is something that I've studied and researched and written about.
Good.
There's a whole chapter on that in my book on the Iraq War, which is called Blood on Our Hands. And what we have to understand about those numbers is that those are numbers generated by passive reporting. Those are the number of deaths that have been reported in the Western media or brought to the attention of the UN office in Iraq or reported by hospitals there. Now, for the last 20 years, people working in the field of epidemiology have worked in war zones all over the world. And what they have found is that that kind of passive reporting generally captures somewhere between 5 and 20% of the actual casualties. Wherever they have gone in and done real epidemiological studies, the same kind they would do in the case of, you know, a disease outbreak or anything else, by going around and surveying households, they have found that, you know, the actual numbers are probably somewhere between 5 and 20 times higher than those numbers from passive reporting. And, you know, as we know, in Iraq, there was, you know, a fair amount of controversy because some of the most experienced war zone epidemiologists in the world, Les Roberts of Columbia University and Gilbert Burnham of Johns Hopkins, went in there and did two epidemiological studies. And when I say that probably more than a million people have been killed in Iraq, that's what I base that on. They, 3 years into the war, found that somewhere between 450 and 900,000 people had died. That's only after the first 3 years of war. So someone else, kind of a British polling firm, updated that a couple of years later to about a million. And the war continued after that for some time. So I think we can very safely say that probably more than a million people were killed there.
Rick, on the subject of the Afghan war, I'd like to interject here that Al Osorio out in Oakland is part of Decolonize Oakland, which is an autonomous group working alongside of Occupy Oakland. In conjunction with Afghans for Peace and the San Francisco Bay Area Iraq Veterans Against the War, next Friday at 3:30, they are staging a protest outside of the recruitment office. The protest is a U.S. massacre of Afghans in Panjawi and Kandahar, as well as other atrocities related to the war. It's also about U.S. military recruitment of poor people in this country.
Sure.
And it raises awareness about the rallying and supporting the U.S.-Afghan Strategic Partnership Agreement. This is going to take place in Oakland. People are meeting up at the Fremont BART station at 3:30 p.m. on the Pacific Coast, and it's about no more killings and no more apologies. And I just wanted to get that in there because that's important information, people standing up, getting out. You know that crowd out there is going to be getting some numbers out there to help them with this protest.
It's so important, I think, for people to bear witness to these terrible crimes. I think as long as the government can imagine that we're not paying attention, that it's not important, that these are people that don't matter, or that they can just hide these things, that they're going to get away with that. But we have to make sure they know we are watching.
Correct.
Listen,
I
I've got
that's
another.
Really-
Absolutely. Let me bring on Brian Stetton. Hold on 1 second. Brian, welcome.
Hi. How's everybody this evening? Thanks
very
for,
good.
Very well.
Hey, Brian.
Hi. How's it going, Sandy?
It's going good. Yeah, we're having a good talk here. So welcome.
Brian, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about your perspective on the Iraq-Afghanistan situation and how we might slow this incredible ongoing massacre.
Well, I was more caught up in what's sort of been going on between, there's sort of this disconnect between, it's a positive thing, between the White House and the media. And New York Times had an article that came out today and basically compared all the analysts that, military analysts and so forth, that study strategy and are firmly against any type of war with Iran. All say it's strategically a horrible idea. It would just crush our economy by dramatically causing oil prices to skyrocket. It would do the opposite of what is needed in terms of getting the people of Iran to push the current regime out. If anything, it would bring them closer to the cleric leader there, the mullahs, and start a regional war and so on and so on. So you have this media, which the mainstream media has almost been promoting it, especially, of course, the right wing, Fox News and so forth, just making the average American feel as if Iran's a direct threat to us.
I actually heard a comment by an NPR interviewer. He was interviewing, I heard an interview with the Iranian ambassador and one of the morning people on NPR, on the morning edition show. And his comment to the Iranian ambassador was, well, what would be wrong with going to war with you people? And the ambassador was literally nonplussed there for a moment. He said, well, actually, this could be very bad for both our peoples.
No, I mean, it's outrageous. But, I mean, the New York Times article compared it to how the mainstream media treats global warming / climate change. I mean, the media defines this very narrow spectrum of political discourse, the far right to, say, what's called the left, CNN and ABC and so forth, which are more like center right. But CNN, for example, say is supposed to be liberal, so adversarial to the government. So anything that's sort of outside of that spectrum is off the map and crazy. So, for example, the global warming debate, you have scientists versus Daryl Issa or some character from a conservative think tank, and that's considered a balanced approach, science versus garbage. You know, and 97%
of
climate. Yeah, I mean, 97% of the climate scientists consider it man-made and a major problem. And the media doesn't even bother bringing up the fact that a third of those scientists feel that it could conceivably end the human race in a generation or two. So likewise, with the war with Iran, 97% of the military strategists, both academic and in the intelligence sector, say, horrible idea. But then you have a garbage sort of promoting it, somebody that's probably working for AIPAC indirectly. There's been a recently started PAC called Emergency for Israel PAC. And basically it's the whole concept is promoting a possible war with Iran. It's just an outrageous media war
going on. And how they're right about Palestine, how Palestine is actually, they're trying very hard to make friends and win over Palestinians, that pact that you were talking about, Brian.
The Emergency for Israel pact?
Yeah.
Outrageous. But
it is.
But what's not even mentioned, though, is on the mainstream media or either side of the spectrum, is that, basically by invading Iraq, we sent out a coded signal that if you don't have weapons of mass destruction, we feel like it, we can go in your country and destroy you. You know, so hence Iran just wants to have deterrence.
Well,
Iran probably deserves to have deterrence. And that's not really discussed.
There's no evidence
I'm sorry.
That they do, Brian. You know, that's the thing. I mean, the
Khamenei keeps saying
over and over again that they don't want nuclear weapons. He regards them as immoral and, blasphemy and everything. I mean, he said everything he could possibly say. It's, you know, as with Iraq, this is a case of the U.S. refusing to take yes for an answer. you know, they're saying we don't have weapons, we don't have a weapons program. The CIA says they had some kind of fledgling program and gave it up in 2003. All the intelligence, Bush in his memoir said, well, you know, I couldn't really attack Iran because my own intelligence agencies were telling me they didn't have a weapons program. And,
ladies and gentlemen, let me ask you to pause for a second. I want to bring on another guest. Hold on one moment.
Okay.
Good evening. Welcome.
Hey, this is Diane G from Wild Wild Left Radio. I'm sorry I'm so late.
That's okay.
We had a little
Diane.
Incident in my neighborhood where there was a gunshot M80 or something, and the cops just came to my door with, like, assault rifles. And went out and asked me if I'd shut off a gun and frisked me. And I'm like, no, I don't do that. And then they're like, okay, ma'am, and went to the next door. It was kind of disconcerting.
I bet. Listen, let me ask you to pause for one more second. What I want to do, I've got some wonderful internet broadcasters here, all progressives, every one of you. And I want you just to say a few words about your shows. That would be Diane and Gwen and Brian. Why don't you go ahead and start, Diane, since you just came on.
Well, I'm Diane from Wild Wild Left Radio, and what basically I have done is created the show because I really wanted to rant one night a week about things that were bothering me. And amazingly enough, somehow the brightest and the best keep speaking with me. And I'm able to bring these wonderful people to working class audiences, and I'm honored and thrilled to be part of the movement and have the show that I have and be affiliated with people like you.
Diane, when is your show on so my audience can tune in?
It is every Friday night at 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and it's Wild Wild Left Radio.
Super.
With Diane G.
Thanks. Gwen, why don't you go ahead and take it away next?
Well, the name of my show is Here Be Monsters. And basically, you know, when we get these shows, we have 7 days a week to fill if we wish to for a couple of hours. And Here Be Monsters started out as a Sunday political discussion show that comes on right before Rick here at 6 p.m. We still do that, Jack Jodell and myself and a lot of wonderful guests. I have joined up with Diane on Fridays. I'm the first one in the Occupy block on Friday doing a mic check show, just running down what's going on with the Occupy community on Fridays. I also open the mic up to several other shows, you know, providing a voice for progressive and left and socialist also voices to come onto the air and speak truth to power.
Thanks so much. And Brian, tell us a bit about your show.
Progress Toward Democracy. It's on Monday night at 11 on the Akasha Temple Network. Wednesday night at 11, I'm sorry, Thursday night at 11, and Friday at 7 o'clock, again, part of the Occupy Marathon block as well. So,
well, super.
Pretty good. And I'm, at this point, I probably classify myself as a anarcho-neo-Marxist, probably, so far left. Now, my only point earlier was is that no one discusses that Iran perhaps has every reason and should have a right to possible deterrence. I'm setting aside, the intelligence that indicates they don't have it anyway.
Yeah, I was just trying to make the point that they don't have a weapons program because the distortions in the media have been so dreadful that I just wouldn't want anyone listening to this to think, even though, yes, I understand that, there would be very good reasons for them to be trying to defend themselves, that, in fact, it's well established by, U.S. even and Israeli intelligence agencies that they do not have a weapons program.
Brian, you
Even the concept, and actually, Sandy, I'd like to ask you, I mean, just the concept of a preemptive war is just it's just morally false, and it's being put to the point of like a thought crime right now. If you're thinking of doing a nuclear, how far back preemptive war goes? I mean,
well,
I
can tell you actually where it goes back to. One very good example of where it goes back to. I don't know if any of you, about a year ago, I did an event in Boca Raton, Florida, with David Swanson and with the gentleman who wrote the preface to my book on Iraq. And his name is Ben Ferenc, and he is the last surviving prosecutor from the Nuremberg war crimes trials. And one of the things he talked about was he was the chief prosecutor of the Einsatzgruppen trial in Nuremberg. This is where they tried 22 senior SS officers for killing more than a million human beings. It's been referred to as the largest murder trial in history. And so Ben talked about this guy, SS Gruppenführer Otto Ohlendorf, who was the lead defendant that he was prosecuting. And he defended the massacres of tens of thousands of civilians, which he was personally charged with an argument that we're very familiar with today. The argument of preemptive self-defense. Ohlendorf told the court that Germany invaded other countries to prevent them from attacking it. His information was, from his commanders, was that Russia, the Soviet Union, was planning to attack Germany, so they were preemptively invading the Soviet Union. Now, asked about why they were killing Jews, he said, oh, well, they had to be killed because everybody knew that they supported the Bolsheviks and the Soviets. So then when Ben asked him, but what about the little children? Why did you have to kill thousands of children? He said, oh, well, that's quite obvious. They had to be killed because if they grew up and found out what the Germans had done to their parents, then they too would become enemies of Germany. And as Ben went on to explain, this illegitimate principle of preemptive self-defense is exactly the same one by which Presidents Bush and Obama justify their war crimes today. We were talking earlier, for those of you who were on, about the fact that these targeted killings are not warfare in the conventional sense. These targeted killings are war crimes. When armed forces target and kill civilians,
that is war criminal.
Those are war crimes. And preemptive war is itself a war crime. It's a violation of the UN Charter, which prohibits
either follow the letter of the law or you do not, and we do not anymore as a society. And you are absolutely right in that. The fact of the matter is, even the people who came to my door tonight with guns drawn, and I have to say, they had automatic weapons pointed at me. And I'm like, what?
That must be terrifying.
No, I wasn't terrified because I had done nothing. I mean, these are my local police department. I stepped out, and I'm like, well, they heard a gunshot. It might have come from my house. Do you own a handgun? Well, yeah. And did you shoot it? Well, why would I? Did you shoot it? Well, why would I? Can we frisk you? Yes, you may. And
well, whereabouts do you live, Diane?
I live in Michigan.
Okay.
And they had heard a sound that, you know, or somebody had reported a sound, and they were going door to door looking for the guilty party that had shot off a gun, which is pretty much legal. I mean, I looked at them and I go, I live in the land of the lakes. I mean, people shoot off guns, M80s, fireworks, 24/7. They asked if I heard it. And I'm like, no, I don't even pay attention to that anymore.
Excuse me, folks.
And they're like, well, we heard it might have been from your house.
Okay, let me interrupt for just 1 second. I've got another guest to come on. This is Dennis J. Plews from the Florida Veterans for Common Sense, who brings us a veteran's perspective. Welcome, Mr. Plews.
Hello there, Richard. How you doing?
Very good. I've got a nice range of guests here. I've got Diane G. of Wild Wild Wet Left. I've got Gwen Holden Berry of Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton of Progress Toward Democracy, Sandy Davies of PDA, and now you, Dennis J. Plews of Florida Veterans for Common Sense. Dennis, why don't you tell us a little about your perspective on the current war situation?
Which one would you like to talk about?
Pick one. Unfortunately, there's far too many for us to cover in a 12-hour period. Let's start with the number one on the hit parade: Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, the whole Mideast arc. Go ahead. Give us your perspective, sir.
Well, Afghanistan, as we all know, has been a historical quagmire and the wrecking ground for many other powerful nations in the past. I even think Genghis Khan had a bit of a hard time there. So the question is, are we doing any good in Afghanistan?
You mean beyond the bribes?
The position of the Florida Veterans for Common Sense that, no, we're not really advancing our national interests to any great extent there. Basically, we feel we're throwing good money after bad. The time to act with respect to the immediate threat that was presented by Afghanistan was back in 2001 and early 2000. And that opportunity was passed upon by the then president. So the question is, what do we do now? Our position is, let's come home. It doesn't seem to the members of our organization, and we do educate ourselves. Our primary mission is to inform the public in our area on matters involving national defense, the military, and veterans. So we regularly bring in speakers. We've had Juan Cole as our probably most notable speaker. We have Harvey Kay, a historian and specialist in the Revolutionary War, and Thomas Paine in particular, come and give lectures. And we also have had lectures by several people from CENTCOM and SOCOM out of the Tampa office, informing us of what's going on in the field in Afghanistan. We've also had Peace Corps workers who spent more than a year in Afghanistan come and give us their perspective. And we've reached the considered reasoned conclusion that the best thing we can do is use diplomatic means to advance peace in the region. Unfortunately, some of the local players there aren't real crazy about peaceful methods, but it seems to us that the local population is the best one to deal with the problem makers in their area. So basically our position on Afghanistan is we got Osama, thanks a lot. We'll help you out, but we're going home.
Dennis, let me ask you one more question,
okay,
if I may. I know you're part of the Democratic Party. Do you see a portion of the veterans who are returning from Afghanistan working with the party at the convention to develop a peace platform?
Well, of course, as a member of the board of directors of the Veterans Caucus, I see a lot of veterans. Matter of fact, at the last convention, one of the veterans with whom I was speaking was a young guy, a Marine, now confined to a wheelchair, but still obviously physically robust and active. And so we're getting a lot of the younger veterans joining in the party to take action on behalf of their brothers and sisters who are still on active duty, and also to exercise such influence as they have in the political arena so as to make sure that we adhere to the principles that led to the formation of this nation, and those espoused by our original founding fathers, George Washington, for example, Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Paine, who all said, you know, running all around the world and trying to act like the bad guy is not a good idea. As a matter of fact, you're likely to just bleed yourself to death. So we've always taken the position that if it's unavoidable, we're ready, willing, and able to defend the nation. However, it has to be unavoidable. If you can find a different way, it's better than shooting people.
Absolutely. Let me ask a question that was raised earlier by several people. I know, Sandy, you mentioned it, and a couple other people, I think, talked about it. When we talk about the fact that this is an election year, we should have about as much attention of the politicians as we ever will have. What kind of tactics do you think we should be using to make sure that there is a movement toward peace in Afghanistan with the president and his people asking for our support? How can we characterize our support so that we know it's dependent on a peaceward motion in Afghanistan? Any thoughts on that?
Being an activist since I got back from Nam, the best way to do it is, first of all, show up. If you don't show up on the field, so to speak, nothing's going to get done. So you've got to get into the game. And the best ways to get into the game are to utilize the existing power structure to your own advantage. That is to say, if you're a Democrat, get involved with the Democrats. If you're an independent, find an organization that you can become active with and promote your issues that way. If you're a Republican, get into the Republican Party's hierarchy and tell them that they're behaving badly and they need to change course. Because right now, the only things I see out of the Republican Party, which used to be an honorable and good group of people who had a different way of looking things, but they're a group you could discuss things with and reach compromises and intelligent conclusions about things over which we might not fully agree. Matter of fact, there was this guy named Ed Brooke. He was a black guy from Massachusetts. He was a United States Republican senator from Massachusetts. So there used to be some good Republicans. So I encourage all of you out there who are good Republicans to get back into the game and tell your party what it needs to do in order to stop fomenting strife in the world. For those of you who are more progressively and liberally minded and are members of the Democratic Party, get down to your DEC and join up and make your voice heard.
I would say as a litmus test, you know, the Republicans successfully applied a litmus test to clear out all their moderates, and now a lot of the moderate Republicans have become Democrats.
Well, we are seeing a surge in population numbers amongst our party, but there's a lot of them who won't do that. But the point I'm trying to make here is, if you want to influence public policy, become active politically.
I noticed in our area, the local Democratic Party basically said, if you're a woman and you're in our area, you can go to the convention. All you've got to do is sign up, because they are looking for people to participate. And maybe that's true in more areas. So if you're in an area where the Democratic Party is latent, what a perfect opportunity for you to participate and move it in a good direction. Gwen, do you have any thoughts in that arena?
Well, I would, if they're taking women, I'd try and find a contingency of feminine occupiers to go along for the ride up there. It's Charlotte, isn't it?
Now, this is,
is where the national convention is supposed to be, at least I'm told that.
Okay, I'm missing.
I was talking about Martin County personally, but I'm sure the same thing is true with so few Democrats participating. It might be a great way of moving the party in a progressive direction.
Well, I'll tell you, over here in Sarasota County, we've had standing room only meetings the last three meetings, and that's new people coming in, not old line party activists showing up. We're being inundated with new members and new volunteers.
Excellent.
We had quite a surge during the 2008 campaign, but it's beginning to look like the 2012 campaign is going to have even a bigger crowd of new people becoming active in the party.
Sandy,
so
you were talking about...
By that, that tells us that the people, whether we the people, in order to form a more perfect union, et cetera, something in the Constitution of that effect, the people are showing up and making their voices heard.
Sandy,
and again, the way to do that is show up.
Excuse me. Sandy, you were mentioning the PDA has some plans for this summer. Could you talk a little bit about what PDA has in the offing?
Yeah, well, what we're working on in terms of Afghanistan is we're supporting Barbara Lee's bill, H.R. 780, which calls for basically prohibits the Pentagon from spending one more penny on anything but a safe and orderly withdrawal of U.S. occupation forces from Afghanistan. And she's had this bill out there for a couple of years. It got voted on as an amendment to the defense bill once. But now what she's trying to do, she's got 70 co-sponsors on this, mostly from the Congressional Progressive Caucus, who of course, PDA works with quite closely. And we've got a national push on between PDA and United for Peace and Justice to get people calling their members of Congress and getting more co-sponsors on this bill. I mean, as things go, you know, down the toilet in Afghanistan for the United States, there are more members signing onto this bill every week or two. Trying to think who the last couple that signed on. There was one from Albany, New York, signed on a couple of weeks ago. And who is Ed Markey from Massachusetts signed on this week. So we're getting there, but Barbara Lee wants to have at least 100 sponsors on this bill by the time she goes to that convention in Charlotte in the summer, because
excellent.
That is the way to really hold Obama's feet to the fire and really show that, I mean, that will be basically a majority of the members of Congress of his own party saying, we bring those troops home now.
Brian,
and,
I'm sorry.
Sorry, go ahead.
Thank you, Sandy. Brian, let me ask you a question. As an anarcho-neo-Marxist or someone outside, shall we say, the typical mainstream tool duopoly of parties, do you see yourself as an information person? Getting the
Democrats.
But overall, I think
people's consciousness needs to be raised. I think the Occupy Fort Lauderdale hopefully will play a role in that, as well as Broward County Progressive Democrats of America chapter running. But I mean, the goal has to be to get people aware that war is basically just another form of class warfare. It's major class warfare. Because you have to look at who pays for the war and who reaps the rewards. And we're all paying for it. And the rewards are being reaped by a few. With people horribly being killed, that's what's called an externality in the financial transaction. So, I mean, it's brutal. That whole nature has to go. So, I mean, the same issue that's leading to environmental degradation, that's leading to the middle class falling to lower and lower levels. This ongoing class warfare is also, you know, a part of our brand of state-sponsored capitalism, American imperialism, which has been very brutal.
Diane?
But it's been remarkably profitable for companies like Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, General Atomics, and the list goes on.
All
their CEOs are...
Diane,
you know,
let me ask you, in the Michigan area... Are you seeing the party moving in a more progressive direction? Are you seeing participation up by progressives, or are you seeing more the old mainline conservative Dems? Diane? Okay, maybe she stepped away. In terms of – let me ask you another question that troubles me greatly. You know, we don't see much in the way of a visible – the visible issue of veterans care. We know there's an awful lot of people who are coming back very, very damaged, people who are being recycled over and over and over again. Obviously, this Master Sergeant Bales is going to be an issue that's going to raise the issue of sending these people back over and over and over again. Is there a way that we can help either A, get this to leverage more veteran help, or B, help us put the issue of the incredible burden these people have had to bear? Mr. Plews, you're a veteran. Can you speak to that, sir?
Well, yeah, veterans, support for veterans issues is something both parties profess. But when you look at the voting record of the members of Congress, you'll find that the Democrats walk the talk and the Republicans just talk. Now, let me give you an example. During the I've been active in presidential politics since George McGovern, when I ran his campaign at the university I was attending, University of West Florida. I've been involved in many of them since. In the last one with McCain and Obama, we were gifted by other veterans organizations who had the time to do it with a comparison chart of the voting records of McCain and Obama as they were in the U.S. Senate. And we would just show that to McCain veterans. I can remember one particularly that saw us with our Veterans from Obama sign on the side of the road one day and actually pulled over and chatted us up and wanted to know why we veterans were supporting Barack Obama. When I showed him the voting history of Barack Obama as compared to John McCain, he promptly said, "I'm switching from McCain to Obama. This guy supports us. McCain doesn't." So if you want any chance of getting better support for veterans issues, if you believe that the past is prologue, you're going to have to run with the Democrats, because they've actually voted to fund fully support for the veterans as they return home, to increase the support at the Veterans Administration to more rapidly address the mental health issues that are manifest as a result of combat experiences. So if you want to help veterans, elect Democrats. And I'll give you another example. For 2 years, Board of Veterans for Common Sense has been promoting and sponsoring a legislation in the Florida legislature to establish a courts assisting veterans, or a veterans court system in Florida, to treat rather than punish, blindly punish veterans who come home and get in trouble with the law because they've got PTSD or they've got a traumatic brain injury that's affecting them, and they get crazy, they get drunk, they go get a DUI, they get in a fight. They might even, we had one veteran up in Jacksonville pop a few caps into the air. He got arrested on a felony. Some judges have, throughout the state, both in Florida and other states, gone on their own and started veterans courts. We have one here in Sarasota, initiated by Chief Judge Lee Hayworth, who also happens to be a colonel in the reserves. He's a JAG officer. Several other judges throughout the state are doing it, but the Republicans and the legislature in the past two sessions have had bills before them to take those homegrown programs and take them statewide, where veterans who get arrested are sent for treatment, not to jail. But this session, the Republicans once again didn't have time to address that particular issue, and the bill died in committee. So again, you have to be politically active. You have to let the people who are running for office know what you want them to do, and that you will insist that they do it if they want your support. So again,
thanks.
Get involved.
Let me
get off the couch. Get out into the street.
There we go. We're down to the last 7 minutes. Let me ask everybody to sort of sum up, make a sum up and final comment. Sandy?
Well, I think we really need to, I think, Dennis is talking a lot about the Democratic Party, and I think, everyone that supported Obama in 2008 has a lot of soul searching to do. I mean, the position PDA is taking on Obama is that we are not telling anyone to vote for him. We are not, involved in his campaign. You know, what we're doing, and this is typical of the way PDA works, we are identifying and endorsing good progressive candidates in Democratic primaries around the country and really going to work for them. We made, I think it was, 8,000 phone calls for Ilya Shaiman in Chicago last weekend. He narrowly lost, but another of our endorsed candidates, David Gill, won his primary also in Illinois. There's a lot of good people out there running for office. But when you go to their websites, when you're considering supporting someone, you know, you really need to look at the issues. Look at their issues. Are they really taking a stand for peace?
Thanks,
Sandy.
Are they
really taking a stand for economic and social justice? Please go to the PDA website, pdamerica.org, and take a look at our endorsed candidates. And let's get some more good progressives in Congress and defend the ones that we've already got, because they are the most valuable thing in this political system.
Great. Let me ask you to be really brief. Brian, if you want to make a closing comment, sir.
I agree with Sandy. We have to get more progressives in office, but also push to basically get the money out of the system that's corrupting it, all the corporate lobbyists. There's 35,000 lobbyists in Washington, D.C. Perhaps we need to experiment with new forms of institutions, because currently our political system is a failure. There's no democracy. I mean, people's opinions and what the government does totally diverge. So what little democracy we have is sort of fiction. So, unless people wake up to that and take it seriously, we're going to be stuck in becoming more and more absolutist as corporations are desperate to get more profit.
Thank you. Gwen?
Hey, I see more corporatist Democrats than I see anything else, unfortunately. True progressives,
yeah.
I support, and work down that road, actively to support them. But most of all, act up, protest, get in the streets, occupy, or be a part of an autonomous group walking along beside occupied, like the Vets groups. We really need to speak truth to power right now, and I think that's the only catalyst that's going to bring us any change.
Thanks very much, Gwen. And Diane? Okay, well, thank you all very much for joining me tonight. I wonder if we can say... Diane, are you there? Guess not. Okay. Well, I want to thank you for joining me tonight for this discussion of peace and different tactics we can use to try to put an end to these useless, pointless, destructive wars. Thank you all, one and all. Thanks, Diane. Thanks, Gwen. Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Sandy. And thank you, Dennis, for joining me tonight. I hope you tune in next week. On behalf of my co-producer, Mickey Royce, and I want to wish you all a peaceful evening. Thanks again so very much, and we'll see you next week. Thanks, guys and girls.
Good night, Rick.
Thank you.
Good night.
Great show. Thanks a lot.
Okay. You all take care.
Bye, Glenn and Sandy.
Good night, everyone.
And there we have it. Thank you all so much. We'll talk to you next. This episode of Progressive News Network has been brought to you by the Media Goddess Worldwide and Imagineering Productions. Thanks again. We'll see you next week.